You're listening to this podcast, so that means you love reading and writing. Want to learn directly from best-selling authors like Brandon Sanderson, Soman Chainani, Shannon Messenger, and more? StoryCon is calling your name. StoryCon is a fun and exciting environment to learn firsthand from best-selling authors and make new friends along the way. Join us at the Salt Palace Convention Center in Salt Lake City on February 27th and 28th, 2026. Use the code MOLE10 to get 10% off your StoryCon adult track admission ticket. That's MULL10. We can't wait to see you there.
Hey there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second. We don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
FanX, welcome to the podcast, Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole. My name is Jason Conforto, and we're going to start this podcast today. This is our third live podcast that we've ever done. So we usually record in Brandon's basement. But today, just so that everyone listening on the podcast later knows that we're actually live, can we just get a big cheer for the room? How loud are we? Okay. We've got 12 people in here acting like, probably like 200 people in here. So anyway,
our live studio audience.
Yeah. Thanks for being here today. We're going to get started. One of the things Brandon was mentioning before is we're going to do a lot of Q&A today for this podcast. But before we get started, Brandon wants to talk a little bit about his new Guardian series. So we're going to let you just kick things off. Let us know a little bit about Guardians. Let us know about the new art that's on the screen and tell us a little bit about this series.
Yeah, so look, we're going to do a big Q&A today, but any author worth his salt also plugs his stuff when he has people in front of him. And so, the series I have coming is called the Guardian series. I'll say a little bit about it. I'll say more about it tomorrow. I'll do a panel at 5 that's like the spotlight on Brandon and like talk about all the future projects. But I'm really excited about this project because it took me about 2.5 years to write book one. Usually it takes me about 6 months to write a book one. It's something that has been cooking in my head for lots and lots of years. If I have something that's kind of like a masterpiece inside of me, it's probably either this or I already wrote it. But I think this might be like one of my best ideas. I'm really excited about it. It's 3 books. Guardians book one, we will meet a character named Mako. It's my first fantasy series where we're in another world the whole time, right? Like most of my fantasies are a fish out of water kind of fantasy. We go through a portal into another world, or we find magic hidden among us like Fablehaven. In Guardians, we'll be in a fantasy world the whole time. Mako is from a race of people called the Anorans. Mount Anora is like it's like a continental apex. It's the tallest mountain on the continent. A lot of rivers flow in different directions from this monumental mountain. And the Anorans have this ability to partner with guardian spirits. And that is kind of the secret of their, they have extra power in the world because of this partnership. They only get to partner with one guardian spirit for their whole life. It's sort of like if you could audition your guardian angel. They go to a place called the Cave of Whispers, which is sort of the pre-interview where they answer any questions that they feel whispered in the cave. And then they go to a bonding hut where they have the chance to interview whatever 3 spirits appear to them. They have to choose between one of those 3, or they could take a chance. And you might get a 4th, you might not. You might get a 5th, you might not. But if you turn down 3, you head into the chance of not losing this huge advantage of having a spiritual guardian That's a little bit about the story world and a little bit about the setup. I don't want to give you too much right now, but I'm really excited about Guardians. It will come out in April of next year, of 26. It should be 3 years in a row, three big books. I'm working on book two right now. And now we're going to get into kind of the podcast portion. Our podcast is called Mulling It Over with Brandon Mull. Jason Conforto is our moderator and host. And let's talk about what we're doing today, Jason.
Yeah, so like I said before, a lot of what we're doing is Q&A. So if you do have a question for Brandon, now is the time to make a line right in front of this microphone. You don't want to wait so long that you don't get your question answered. So we're going to open it up to questions. It looks like we already have somebody up front. So tell us your name and your question.
So my name is Marin Dietz, and I have a question because I'm currently trying to write my own book, and I need to get this question answered because I'm still kind of confused on it, but how do you make a character sound like they're stuttering without having, like, being like a stereotypical stutter?
Wow. How do you make a character sound like they're stuttering without making it a stereotypical stutter? I mean, that, to me, that is a research question, okay, right? So I have done a stuttering character before, and I was young enough and dumb enough that I didn't do tons of research on it. So I probably could tell you how to do a stereotypical version of a stutterer. I've had a couple friends who stuttered. I leaned on that a little bit. But like what I would do if I was trying to nail it is I would get on YouTube and look at some people who stutter and try to catch the rhythms, right? You just want a little bit of the rhythm. On a stutter in a book, in print, you probably don't want to overdo the stutter because you want to keep it legible. Sometimes in fiction, we cheat, right? And with if someone had a heavy stutter, I would cheat toward comprehensibility because we need to comprehend the text, right? Unless it was vital that they were incomprehensible in a certain moment. That's pretty much the answer.
I think another thing you could consider, too, is when you're writing a book, you get to be inside the character's minds. And one thing that people who don't stutter don't understand is the frustration that's going on inside their mind. And so the time that you can spend there, inside their mind, inside their frustration, why can't they express themselves the way they want to express themselves? I think that would do more service than like Brandon's saying, leaning into the stuttering and then ending up in a place where you're making fun of a disability, which is the last thing you want to do. Instead, you want to give honor to people with different disabilities and showcase what they're going through. So
yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, if it's a point of view character, being inside that mind, and if it's not a point of view character, clues as to what they're experiencing. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, right. That was a really good question. You guys, just to kind of like fertilize your minds. Maybe that's not the right word. To seed your minds. I write fantasy adventure novels, so we could go anywhere about fantasy. I've been doing this for a long time. We've got books that are being trying to get it made into movies, and so I know a little bit about that side of the industry. I know a little bit about picture book side of the industry. I know a little bit about agents and publishing and writing. So we can go all those different places if you want. That's not because that question was or wasn't something. That was just to seed everybody's brains. Okay, go for it.
Okay, so my question is, like I said earlier, I just got a job, so now I can start writing my book.
Yeah.
What programs would you suggest a writer use? Like, some people use Microsoft, some people use others. Which one?
Yeah. For doing the practical writing, this was something that I wondered about, too, when I was getting started, was like, do I need a certain program, a special program? What I've learned so far in my life is I just needed Word. When I did screenwriting, I got a program that did formatting for a screenplay. That made it a lot easier, and I talked to Jason about that because he knows how to do that. But I don't do a lot of screenwriting. What I usually do is prose, and every publisher I've worked with, which is Random House and Scholastic and Simon & Schuster and Shadow Mountain, they all just take stuff from Word if I submit it in Word. It becomes more about what do I fill Word with than what program do I have. Maybe as a side note, something that I sometimes use now when I'm brainstorming is I do use ChatGPT as my sidekick. Like Google was my sidekick, right? And ChatGPT is now my sidekick if I need brainstorms. And to be really clear about how I would use a program like ChatGPT, because it's kind of relevant, it's there. If I used it to write for me, I would be cheating my audience, right? Because like they're paying me to write the story in my voice. But if I'm writing a scene with a riverside dock, and I need to seed my mind with, like, what's 50 things I might see at a riverside dock to get my juices flowing? ChatGPT can accelerate my brainstorms in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So something like ChatGPT I'll use in that way, and then otherwise I'm just using Word.
Okay.
Awesome. Great question.
Yep. And you know what? There might be other people with other opinions on great novel writing software, but for me that's always sufficed.
Hi, my name is Whitney. I wrote a book, but I am just in the editing process, and I'm also trying to figure out how to summarize my novel in a way that's concise while also being interesting.
Yeah.
I feel like I ramble a lot about it, so I'd love to hear your feedback on that.
Yeah, so this is kind of like how to create a pitch for your novel. Is that the question? Am I understanding
yes.
right?
Yeah.
And so this is one of the hardest parts of being a novelist is, and you just saw me kind of fumblingly try to do that with Guardians, right? I tried to give you like a little summary of what Guardians is about. That was the first time I publicly tried to summarize Guardians. It was the first time I publicly tried to summarize it because I haven't had a chance yet. Like this was my
Which
first time.
Which also means you guys were the first group to see that pitch.
Yeah. You are the first group to ever see that pitch, and that means it's probably the worst it'll ever be. So, you know, it's got that upside and that downside. Here's the thing, writing a novel, we get to inhabit scenes and inhabit characters, and the whole skill set of writing a novel well is utterly different than the skill set of summarizing a novel well. They are two separate skill sets. So that might be something to notice up front. And if you're a writer and you're trying to sell your work or you're trying to get others excited about your work, it's worth noting that you need to also have like this, develop a little bit of a marketing side to your writing. Just enough so that you can do this and write a pitch. So I used to write the backs of novels and the backs of DVDs. I was a marketing copywriter. And so that was a really useful thing for me developing pitches because I got to practice helping other people pitch their books. And so here's a couple succinct things I learned. One, when you are making your summary of your book, you are not telling the story of your book. You are telling a story. And when I say that, as the writer of the book, you're in love with all the scenes and all the characters. You're in love with your story, and you want to somehow share it all in a summary. And that is impossible, right? And so you're not going to tell the story. You're going to pick a hooky aspect of your story, and you're going to explore that hooky aspect of your story. Now, what you just saw me do with Guardians, the hooky aspect of my story that I chose was, okay, it's kind of cool when they go to the bonding hut and they have to choose a guardian spirit that they partner with. This happens in the first maybe quarter of the book, and it's a moment that to me is a moment of interest, and so I talked about that as maybe something that could draw in an audience. I still don't know if that's the best moment of interest to mention yet, but it was a moment of interest that I went with.
But
right?
It is the climax of Act One, right? This whole thing, and centering your pitch around there is good. Also verbalizing your pitch, right? I know you're talking about a written pitch, but like practice pitching to your friends. Tell them about your book. Time how long it takes. They don't need to know you're timing it, but time. And then when you go, oh, that was 15 minutes, and I need to do an elevator pitch in like 15 seconds, like where do I need to adjust? So.
One simple example of one that I have honed nicely. My pitch for Fablehaven is this. A brother and sister discover their grandparents are the caretakers of a secret wildlife park for magical creatures. That's it, right? And that's a good pitch. Why? Succinct. I didn't bore anybody. You got, and with your pitch, you're trying to do two things. Who's the story for, right? Which isn't necessarily in that sentence that I said, though you could hint at it. A brother and sister kind of suggests a young audience, right? But with your pitch, you want to tell your reader who the story is for and what makes it, who the story is for, what category it's in, right? And what makes it different than everything else in that category in a cool way. That's the pitch. So what makes your story different than everything else in the category it's in a cool way? You think about what angle of attack do I use to show why my story is different than everything else in this category in a cool way. And lots of thinking, lots of practicing, lots of saying it out loud. And it is art, not science, so you can always be changing it, right? Like until you find something that's hooky. With Fablehaven, when I say it's a brother and sister who discover their grandparents are the caretakers of a secret wildlife park for magical creatures, I've sold millions of copies of books on that pitch, right? And it's simple. It doesn't have to be complicated. In fact, what it needs to be is, if you can, simple, right?
Yeah. Brandon, what's the difference between pitching an audience versus pitching an agent and a publisher, and especially when it comes to spoilers and ending and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, like, look, you can give up any spoiler or any ending when you're pitching a publisher. When I'm pitching an audience, I will pitch it with like a line, right? Like I'll pitch it pretty short, but I'll give a little more meat on the bones. When I'm pitching a publisher, I make it really, really, really simple. I have found that the simpler I can make it, they see lots and lots and lots of pitches. So if it's not something they have to wade through, and they can get a really succinct, clear view of who the story is for and what makes it different than everything else in the category, you increase your chances that you'll hear back from them, I think. Cool. That was a great question.
Whitney.
Yeah, you got
Thank
me going.
You.
Yeah, thanks for the good question.
Hi, I'm Courtney.
Hi, Courtney.
Okay, what are your biggest tips on world building for a fantasy world?
Okay, tips on world building for a fantasy world. This is a big question. We could do a whole panel on it. So I'll give you, but that makes it a great question, right? I'll give you what I can in a couple minutes, right? To me, the art of world building is thinking through all the consequences of the rules you've changed in your fantasy. Even taking a step back from that, so that we're all on the same page. You could define fantasy as a story where anything could happen. Most of us who are into it wouldn't describe fantasy like that, because in a story where anything could happen, there's no consequences that matter, right? And we want to write stories where the consequences matter. And so we would maybe define a fantasy as a story where the rules of reality are different in some way from our reality. To me, that's the clearest definition I can think of of fantasy, is we have changed the rules of reality in some way. So to me, any story that has changed the rules of reality has now become fantasy. And the art of world building is, now that I've changed the rules of reality in some way, maybe a minor way, maybe in a couple major ways, but now that I've changed the rules of reality, I have to think through what that looks like, having changed the rules of reality. And like one of the examples I like to think of for this is, if I were a sci-fi writer in the year 1800, and if I looked ahead and said, I'm going to write a story, I'm looking at a wagon right now, and wow, that would be really cool if that wagon didn't need a horse, if it could self-propel. So I'm going to make up a fantasy story where there's automobiles, where there's cars, right? Step one would have been that cool idea of a self-propelling wagon, right? Now, step two, where the world building comes in, is you go, if we had self-propelling wagons, if we built cars, how would the world be different than it is without cars? Now, this is an easier question to answer for us, because we can see some of that answer, right? But if you were a really good sci-fi writer back in the olden days and you wrote a book about cars, you would be thinking things like, if people had cars, they could live far from where they worked. So you could have suburbs. If people have cars, if they had suburbs, we'd probably improve the roads. So we might have big artery roads for these fast self-propelling cars. We might have freeways. If people were coming in from the suburbs, that might cause traffic on those roads. We might have traffic jams. We might make specialized vehicles like ambulances and fire trucks. There might be vehicles for war like tanks. We might race these vehicles. We might make racetracks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And what would happen to the poor horses? How many of them would still be around? Would we ride them as a novelty? Would we ride them? Would we still ride them for certain purposes, like going off road or into the mountains, or right? Like all the what if questions is the world building, right? So it's amazing how you can tweak one little thing like adding cars and change the whole flow of a society, right? And an example for me from my books would be, I created in my Beyonder series, I created a race of people called the Amar Cabal. And the Amar Cabal are the people of the seed. They have a little seed at the base of their skull. If you kill one of these people, that seed pops out, and it brings a little piece of their brain with it. So if you plant that seed, they can regrow and live again, right? If I made that rule, then you have to go, okay, well, you've made a rule that there's a race of people with a seed in their head. You kill them, you can plant the seed, they can be reborn. Then you have to think through, what are all the implications of that? That's where the world building happens, right? And implications might be things like, at what age are they reborn, right? Are they reborn as a baby? Are they reborn, like, how are they? I decided they would be reborn at the age that they're killed.
The first time.
The first time. Yeah, exactly, Jason. Yeah. So if you were born as the immarkable in the immarkable, if you're born that age you first die, when your seed pops out, that's the age every time in the future you will be reborn at that age. And so because of that, would you want to die in your deathbed if you remember the immarkable? You would not want to die of old age on your I guess you would always die in your deathbed. Sorry. You would not want to die of old age on your deathbed, because then you would be reborn in your old age on your deathbed, and you would just like cycle through a pointless thing of death and rebirth. You would want to die younger. You probably wouldn't want to die as a baby, because who wants to be reborn as a baby again and have to go through all that? And so I decided in this society they would probably have a ritual death around age 20, which looks like happy birthday to you as I stab you to death, right? Which is so sick and twisted, but also, given the rules of their reality, it makes perfect sense that you would probably have some sort of ritual death at 18 or 20, so you could then be reborn as a young adult every time thereafter, right? That is one piece of the world building I had to think through for the immarkable. There's other things, lots of other world building that I had to think through for the immarkable, like your grandpa could be younger than you after he's been reborn, and that creates interesting family dynamics. Or like, what happens with, it gives me a chance to have a hero die a brave, heroic death and then bring him back into the story without cheating, which as a writer is so useful, right? And so like, that's my little summary of world building. I'm trying to show you by example. You play with ideas. You like, to me, world building is the funnest part of fantasy. You say, what could be and what would happen if it was like that? And you just daydream about it like crazy. And you think about it so long and hard that if someone went into your story world, it would feel real because you fleshed it out so well on what all the consequences would be of all the rules you've changed. Does that make sense?
You can see this happening in superhero movies, especially origin stories. When you get your superpower, the first thing you do is you explore the limitations of your new power, right? So that's what Spider-Man's doing on top of the world, or on top of the roof, is he is world building. He's figuring out, how far can I jump? What does it mean that I can do this now? What does it mean that I can fall off a building and shoot a web and catch myself? And so they're exploring in the same way that a writer has to explore in those situations. So
that's a really good thought, Jason. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, good question. What do you got?
All right, my name is Kimball, and I have three problems with writing. The first is I have 30 ideas, but I haven't written a single one in a book yet.
Yeah.
My second is I don't have a lot of time because I'm in school and I have a family. And three, I'm too afraid to write my ideas because I've heard that the first few books are going to be trash, and I don't want my
precious ideas to be trash.
Exactly. So in my position, with these three things and probably more, what would you do to be able to fix that?
Okay. These are good thoughts, and I bet a lot of writers can relate to some of these problems, right? The first thing I would tell you is don't overthink it so much. Okay? Like, and I know that's easy to say, but don't overthink it so much. Is useful for the kinds of anxieties you are sharing with me. You know what I mean? Because if you overthink it too much, you might never write this stuff, right? And I bet your ideas are cool, and I bet they deserve to be written. So what was issue number one again? It was time?
Too many ideas.
Okay, so one of the things we do as writers is we sort our ideas. Like our commodities are our good ideas, right? And so I actively think about this all the time. Is I am now 50 years old. I've been writing professionally for 20 years. I'm aware that it takes me about a year to write a book. I'm aware it takes me about 5 years to write a 5-book series, which makes me aware that I only have so many series and books left in me before just time runs out, right? Before I'm either too addled or too dead to write another book. And so I'm hoping I got, 20, 30 good years left in me. I want to live a long, healthy life. I'm going to try. But I'm also aware that it's finite, right? And so my idea is always I'm trying to write my best ideas. Sometimes we get curious. Sometimes we want to store our best ideas. You can a little bit. That's okay, a little bit. If there's like a really special one that you think you need to be a better writer to tackle it, that's kind of what I did with Guardians. That was a special one that I stored for some years, right? But like, In general, you want to write most of your best ideas first because there's only a finite time you have to write them. And you want to write some of your very best ideas first. And some of your very best ideas are the ones that are the easiest pitch. Best idea meaning most sellable, right? Like if you're trying to sell something, think through, you've got 30 ideas, think through, which of these can I write a really great pitch for? Which is an easy get, right? Where like, what makes this different than everything else in the category in a cool way? Which one's the easiest get, right? Like that would be one way to parse it. Also, which one gets you the most excited where you're like, I'm so excited about this one. I'm almost scared to write it, I'm so excited. You should be scared to write it if it's a cool idea that you love. You should be a little bit scared. You should be hoping you're a writer enough to pull it off, right? And then you go figure it out. Like that's the game. That's what you're doing, okay? So that's idea number one. What was number two?
Time.
Time. Time is always a monster. Time is always an enemy. But here's the beautiful thing. How do you eat an elephant?
One bite at a time.
One bite at a time. And you can break down those bites as little as you need to. You can write a novel tiny bites at a time, right? You can write a novel. You first, like if I go, I'm going to write a novel, my brain breaks. If I go, I'm going to write a 6-page scene to start my novel, that I can do. At least that I can start to do, right? And maybe it takes days or weeks to write that first scene, but the first scene is a manageable project, right? And you just do that. Like when I wrote Fablehaven, I was working full-time. I had a new baby at home, and I wrote it on nights and weekends. And I just carved out little, and I wrote it in 5 months in fragments of time. And so that's proof it can be done. I've done a few books like that, and then when I became a full-time writer, that felt so good because I had more time. And even with more time, it's still, you still have to make the time. You know what I mean? It's still kind of the same mess. You know what I mean? And so like the time, you just have to make the time. Like if you care enough, you make the time. And then the third one was?
And this is the interesting thing about the third one. It's actually the only real one. The other two are excuses. The real issue was the fear. Right, being afraid to write this, right? That's the real issue that you need to conquer. But
yeah,
I'm sure you face that.
Is that the heart of the third one? Is the fear? Yeah. And so here's the thing, man. Like to help you with this fear of not doing justice to the cool idea, remember that your first draft is draft zero if you need it to be. It's not even draft one. It's draft zero. First draft, you are shoveling sand into the sandbox so you can eventually make sandcastles, right? And so, like, that is, when you think of it like that, it's, like, a little more doable, right? I had to tell my wife this just a little while ago. She was ghostwriting for somebody. I was like, honey, just shovel sand into the sandbox. Like, if you're feeling overwhelmed, just put stuff in the sandbox, and we'll figure it out later. You'll sculpt it later, right? Like, if you write a craptacular draft zero, like, congratulations, you've written a draft. You know what I mean? And then craptacular draft zero, you sculpt into a good draft one eventually. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you got to have the courage to shovel sand into the sandbox. Just get stuff down, make scenes up. Remember, like, good novels happen with good scenes. So what's a scene you want to experience? What's a scene you want the readers to experience? Start there. What's a good scene? What's a good scene? What's a good scene? Learn how to write a good scene. You can write a good novel. Cool?
Cool. Yep. Thank you so much. Now I'll start writing.
Yeah. Great job. Yeah. Hey, and then also remember, everyone is afraid. Everyone's afraid to do something, and once you make that step to go past that's the hardest step. Once you make that one step, you start writing, you're going to have success.
Yeah. Think about how much of fear tends to be in the anticipation of the thing. And then when you start the doing of the thing, the fear tends to fade a little bit, at least for me. Like, the anticipation of the thing, for me, is 10 times scarier than once I'm moving. Anticipating the speech, anticipating the book, anticipating Guardians, oh, this is like my best idea. What if it's not masterpiece enough? Yeah, that could freeze me, right? But you start working on it, and then you demystify a little bit. Okay, you're up.
Okay. Hi, I'm Meg.
Hey, Meg.
I have finished my book, and I am trying to get an agent at this point. So I'm about to go live pitch to agents in a few weeks. I'm going to an event, so there's six
cool.
different agents. What? I've never done this before, so what can I expect? It's about 5 minutes. I've got a 2-minute pitch prepared.
Okay, so this is where I'm gonna phone a friend. So we've got a guy in the audience, Chris Schobinger. Come up for me. So Chris is the head of a publisher called Shadow Mountain, right?
And you get to pitch him live in front of everybody right now.
but if you want, you are welcome to pitch him. But also, like, would you like to do a pitch? Would you like to try a pitch?
I am not going to turn it down. Yeah, let me find my pitch here.
Yeah, go ahead and pitch it.
give us a short.
And then we're going to let, because Chris does get pitched at these things, and we're going to let Chris give you some tips and thoughts about what to do in this situation. Does that make sense?
That sounds great. Cool. Okay, so hi, I'm Meg Shaw.
Don't be nervous.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not nervous at all. Yeah. Okay.
This is a very standard first pitch scenario.
Okay, yeah, I've never done this before.
Like a huge crowd of judgy nerds. Like.
In front of everybody. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, all right. Ember is homeless and secretly living in a grand library when two thieves break in and force her into their heist. She loses control of her invariable powerful magic. Revan, a shunned magic professor, witnesses her incredible potential and proposes an opportunity Ember desperately needs. She'll just need to give up everything she has left. Morning Cloak is my 105,000-word new adult romance fantasy and is the competition theme of A Throne of Glass meets the slow-burn chemistry of The Love Hypothesis. So Ember lives in fear. The uncontrollable power simmering under her skin will capture the attention of the corrupt mage's court. They discovered her brother's power and took it for themselves. Despite her constant anxiety and self-doubt, she's willing to do whatever it takes to buy his freedom. Revan has only 2 weeks to train Ember for the prestigious tournament of mages. She'll need to risk her life, but if she wins, she gets a cut of the prize. To complicate matters, a magical contract makes physical touch between Ember and Revan impossible. Well, almost. Tension runs high amid magic lessons, late-night chess games, and terrible oatmeal, and the emotions she's feeling for him are strenuously inconvenient, especially when they coincide with her plans to steal all the prize money and run. Morning Cloak is book one of a planned 3-book series with a found family and well-loved tropes, including forced proximity, different worlds, forbidden love, and he falls first. I'm an executive assistant by day, aspiring novelist by night. I write formal letters, technical documents, and commending awards to government officials with the hope that one day my name will appear on something I wrote. I'm a member of Writing Away Refuge and dream of becoming a career novelist.
That's great.
Good job. Cool.
So I don't want to take too much time. Tell me your name again.
Meg.
Meg. There are a lot of things right about that. You should be very proud. You've spent a lot of time on this, right?
Yes.
Like, a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, you can tell. Even everything from your comp titles, right? Making sure I understood where this book would fall on the bookshelf.
Yes.
Super important, right? If you're pitching a your novel, make sure the publisher knows where you think that book is going to sit on the shelf. I love that you gave the word count, super important. 105,000 is probably okay for a new adult. And is it young adult?
It's new adult. It's a romance fantasy.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, I think you're probably close to that because a good editor is going to chop 10,000 words out of that anyway. There's a lot to like about that. What world is it? Is this a new world that you created?
Yeah, it's a pure fantasy.
Yeah, so no, there's a lot to like about it.
Chris, what do you look for when people pitch? Like, what are you looking for?
Yeah, if I were to ask you to really dig a little bit deeper now, if you literally only had one sentence, right?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say?
I'm still working on that one sentence.
Yes. And this is called the elevator pitch, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you literally only have one sentence, and it can't be a really long sentence. Right?
That's the hard part.
But what I would suggest, and this is something that is a great exercise, right? Because there's a lot of good things, but now we really got to hone in, right, on the thing that matters most.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to, for example, Publishers Weekly, or any of the trade journals, where they are showing titles that have recently been purchased by editors, right, or publishers. And when they announce those titles, they will create a small, like little 1 to 2 sentence pitch.
Very short blurb, yeah.
Very short, okay. Very short. But this has been being done, again, by acquisition editors, right? They want everyone to know why they're so smart and they pick this book up, right? So they have now, really mined this pitch into that one and two sentences. The best thing I can recommend is go and study those one or two line pitches, right?
Okay.
And then go back to yours and say, okay, how could I mirror this, right?
Yeah. So that mine, what's my version of
yeah,
that?
What's
right?
my version of that? So that it's as strong and hooky, you know, as you can make it.
Okay.
Yeah, so that longer part of your summary, you're sorting through that,
right?
And going, what's just really cool, like, and it doesn't sum up the whole book, but it sums up a really cool aspect of the book, right?
Okay,
like
right.
The most gettable, cool, different aspect of the book, and you lead hard with that because that simplifies it for them. Like with the length of the pitch that I was hearing, I got lost on, wait, what's cool, what's cool, what's cool? I got a little lost, you know what I mean? Like, and everything was kind of cool, but I got a little lost. I'm like, what exactly is this, right?
Oh.
And so, like, you zero in like that on a line or two, and then they have that easy, clear vision of, oh, that's how I market this, right? And, like, you're either wrong, you're right, but you give them something that they can, like, you've already done the sorting and the thinking for them, you know?
Yeah. This 5 minutes you have with them too, it's a two-way interview. They're not just looking, you need to look at them and say, are they the right agent for me?
Right.
Is this the type of book they want to? So instead of spending the whole time talking about the book, ask them questions about what they're looking for. Make sure that they are like you guys are in line for this partnership, because you don't want to end up with an agent that doesn't know what to do with your book, right?
Right.
So we were just at a conference doing the podcast. In fact, next month, our next episode that comes out for this podcast, we're live at Quill's conference, which is a writing conference where agents are talking about, they would say people have a few minutes with me. They spend the whole time talking and I don't get a sentence in. And I know nothing about them, they know nothing about me, and we'll never talk again, right? And so make sure you use that time to build that relationship with them and see if it's a good fit.
Yeah,
so.
build some rapport. Remember, like, think like a sales guy, you know? Like, think like you're doing summer sales out in California trying to sell solar. Like, you're trying to get the person in the door to talk to you a little bit, right?
Right.
To build a little rapport so they don't, like, slam the door on you, right?
That's great, like, to ask of an introvert. Yeah.
And like, remember, yeah, no, we all are. Everyone in this room. Or, like, 90%, right? Like, that's why we're wearing masks. Like,
no. But great job, and great job taking advantage of the opportunity you had today. So, very good.
Yeah, good job.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I will say that you do have an opportunity to do some homework before you even meet that
yes.
the editor. And I will tell you that because somebody pitched me a book idea. They had clearly, and I hate to say this, but had been stalking me in some way. And they pitched a book that of two books, or one was a movie, that I love. Now, the only way they could have done that is through social media. Right?
Yeah.
And like they pitch it as Knives Out Me, Six of Crows. Those are some of my favorite stories.
I love
right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, I send that manuscript to me. Like it was like no brainer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, I have to make a confession, right? And they, but I'm like, kudos to you, right?
Yeah.
Like
I know all your
move.
Kids' names
yeah.
and birth dates
yeah.
and
yeah.
your social security number.
Yeah. Yeah. Chris, I know you like parking under that oak tree, don't you? Feels nice and safe, doesn't it?
All right.
Okay, yeah.
Thanks.
So just remember there's a human side to it. You're going to pitch, and then you're going to, like, present magical you, right? Like
okay.
show a little interest in them, let them ask some questions about you, do, like, a little job interview, you know what I mean? And also
okay.
pitch
mm-hmm.
your story well.
Yep.
Okay?
And talk to them. Don't read it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. As best you can. As best you can.
Best
yep.
I can. Talk. Okay.
Practice right. and talk to them.
Yep.
Right.
Great
Thank
job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good. That's useful for lots of people. That's a good question.
I will say a lot of times editors will include manuscript wish lists online. Like you can actually find
oh, wow.
what those wish lists are, what they're looking for, right? So
wow.
so again, you
So do your homework and
yeah.
bring them something they want,
yeah.
right? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I just answered one of my questions. I actually edit my husband's original story, so which is awesome.
Cool.
And this is like falling. So,
yeah.
Hi, I'm Jill.
Hey, Jill.
I don't write my original stuff, but I do play around in other people's universes writing fan fiction. I find myself pretty decent at conversations and prose and
yeah.
introspection, but I suck at battle scenes. And I am to the point in my current story that I need a battle scene. Any ideas, any help, please?
Yeah. I can give you a couple ideas because I have to write battle scenes. Here's one of the hard things about battle scenes is I think about how my wife experienced stories, right? When I was a kid experiencing stories, I experienced stories largely for the battle scenes. Like, this was partly why I was reading, partly why I went to the movies. I wanted to see the awesome stuff. My wife is the exact opposite of me. To her, the battle scenes were like the kissing parts for me when I was a little boy. You know what I mean? Like, for the battle scenes, are like, okay, let's get back to, like, the actual people and the actual relationships. You know what I mean?
Right.
And seeing it through her eyes helped me realize, okay, they're both important. And how do I make these battles matter for people, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, part of it's this. Part of it's really fun when you're reading a book and somebody gets punched in the face. It's really fun. Or something blows up. But it means more and is cooler when you understand why they were punched in the face and why that mattered and what happened afterwards. So part of this is, what are the stakes of your battle, right? Like, okay. We have to know why. The more you understand why your battle matters for the people involved, for the story at large, why it matters is part of the answer to this question, right? So, okay, why does this battle matter? Make sure you set up why it matters. Also, okay. What can this battle, because we've seen so many battles and so many books and so many stories. I've written so many battles and so many books and so many stories. So part of my question is, how do I not write the same battle over and over, right?
Right?
He swung, he missed, or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, how do I not write the same battle over and over? Part of it is, use everything that's unique to that story to its advantage.
Okay.
Does that make sense? If there's any magic unique to that story, make sure that magic is involved in the battles in cool ways,
okay.
Right?
So the story I'm playing around with is Miraculous Ladybug, and I don't know if anybody... Okay.
A little bit.
I
my daughter better than me, but yeah.
Okay. Well, I hear a couple of fans back there. My pitch on this story is basically, what if Hawk Moth isn't Gabriel Agreste because Gabriel Agreste isn't Gabriel Agreste? Okay. Anyway, that was that pitch. So I've got my superheroes.
Yeah.
And I know how that world works, and so I know they might have to go off and like recharge and that kind of stuff. But they've got this other character in, which is the real Gabriel, that they're going to confront the big bad.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to. So I know what the stakes are. The stakes are Gabriel needs his life back.
Okay.
Here's
the last piece of advice I have on this is that there's choreography to a fight.
Okay.
But a fight's more interesting when it's a chess match, right?
Okay.
And so we have to kind of understand how's the big bad using their strengths, and then how are we countering those strengths with our strengths? If that comes across and then the choreography is secondary, that's how I do a battle.
So
does that make sense?
Yeah. So we're going, and then they counter us, and then we find something and counter them, and
until you find something that's satisfying to you on how that battle could plausibly end, right?
Okay.
And it's really nice when a battle's really hard fought and it's hard to win.
Okay.
It's nice when the hero fails sometimes. All that can be nice. There's ways to recover from that when the hero fails, you know?
So like a minor fail that then becomes a bigger success.
Yep, all those little things, all those little ups and downs. You're just trying to put as much story into the battle as you can. Any thoughts,
right.
Jason?
Well, no, I was just going to say this. We've got about 10 minutes left. We've got a huge line. So I think we're going to play a game called Lightning Round.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is you're going to come in. You're going to give a quick question. Brandon's going to give a brief, fast answer, not because he doesn't care about you or the answer, but he's going to do his very best to give a nice, brief answer.
Yeah.
We're going to get through as many of these as we can.
Okay,
Lightning Round. Let's go for it.
So when you're creating characters and you write details like, oh, this character has blue hair, this guy's short, how do you keep track of all those details so you don't, like, say he's short in one chapter and then five chapters later you say he's tall? Like, do you have a cheat sheet word document?
Yeah, okay, so a couple things. Thing one, I have a weird brain that holds on to those details pretty good. That's useful. That's just a lifetime of daydreaming, and for some reason I hold on to those details pretty good. But that doesn't mean I always hold on to those details. You can make a story Bible. I whenever I have a book I'm writing, I have like Guardians, Forbidden Mountain, chapter 6 is one document that's open, and Forbidden Mountain Notes is the other document that's open. And as I establish ages or hard details about my characters, I try to drop that into a notes document, right? Something that I learned really recently that's really useful, I could be like a spokesman for ChatGPT on this one, but like if you have, at least on my, I subscribe to ChatGPT Plus, which is the $20 a month version. With that, I can make a custom GPT. I've made a custom GPT where I preloaded all of Forbidden Mountain Book 1 into it, and now I have a little genie that can I can say, like, in all of its instructions on what you do on a GPT, you tell me what I want to know about the book you have loaded, and I say that in lots of ways so that I have this little robot that I say, what color was this guy's hair? And it tells me. That's another way to do it.
Great, great question. Midna, you're up.
Yeah. How to improve your prose other than just practice, because I'm already practicing, but I feel like it's not getting better.
Okay, how do you improve your prose? Get really sensory, right? Make sure you're hitting all the senses, right? So like get really good at doing smell, get really good at doing sound, because sometimes we get really visual. So part of it is get really sensory. Also, it is a huge part is read a lot, write a lot, right? So pay attention to how your favorite authors are doing it. My suggestion on this is when you read a really good scene that puts you into a reader's trance, right? You trance out and you're lost in the scene. Go back a second time and see how that was done, okay. Right? Enjoy the trance the first time. That's what you're reading for. But then if you want to be a writer, go back a second time and say, man, they totally had me in a trance. Word by word, how'd they do it, right? Okay. And you'll just keep tuning your ear how to write better and better prose.
Okay, thank you.
Awesome, great. Yep, good question.
Hi, I've written lots of books and now I want to publish stuff, and so I'm trying to get into that, but I have no clue what I'm doing. Like, what do I need to know? Because I'm kind of just told scary stuff.
What are the basics of getting started?
Yeah.
Chris, what are the basics of getting started, if you summed it up fast?
So, as far as pitching?
As far as she has written a book and now she wants to get it published, what should she be thinking about?
So, you want to make sure you can connect with an editor or a publisher that really is interested in what you're writing about, right? So do your homework. And the best source I can give to you is Publishers Marketplace, right?
Okay.
So it's online. I think it's a $25 subscription per month, but it is probably one of the most valuable resources, right? To reach out to credible editors and agents, right? Mainly agents. So Publishers Marketplace.
Publishers Marketplace, you can subscribe to that. It will have info on where and how you can submit stuff, right? And then you...
And exactly what they're looking for, right? It will tell you what they're looking for, what they specialize in, what was their last deal, right? That sort of thing.
So research, who do I want to give this to, right? Use your 25 bucks that you spent to research who's the best person to get this book in front of, right? And then, you know, do your homework on query letters and how you pitch stuff. Cool. Yeah.
All right. I think we got time for the doctor and both the doctors. We'll do both the doctors and then we'll be done.
Okay. So my question is not about writing, but when you wrote the character Kendra in Fablehaven, did you realize that it would divide a family and we would spend 3 hours talking about whether she deserved what she got in Fablehaven or not?
I did not know that, but it makes me very happy. And here's why it makes me happy, is because anything that you write, you hope it has some emotional resonance for your reader. You hope that the reader cares, that it comes to life a little bit for them. And the only reason you would debate about this girl who has never existed is because she came to life a little bit for you. And that makes me delighted. And like when I hear an adult that's like, I want her to spank Seth, I'm like, he's not real, but you are emotionally reacting. And that means I did my job right. You know what I mean? I want you to care about these characters and feel like they're real. So what you're telling me just makes me very happy. Because I know if I can keep people reacting and engaged, I will have a job.
Well, everywhere from my grandma to my little brother love your books. So
that makes me so happy. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Last question.
Hello again.
Yeah. Sweet
Crouch. So my question is, for your stories, do you write outlines? And if so, how long does that take you?
Yeah, good question. So the whole pre-writing process is a complicated process. There's lots of ways to approach it. For me, I approach it by daydreaming about the story like a movie in my head over and over. That's because I have a weird brain. Like I said, I can't remember an age where I didn't make up stories in my mind. I've done it my whole life. I've got good beefy muscles for making up stories. That's some of the only beefy muscles I have probably, but But like those are my good beefy muscles. And like, but whether you're doing it in your head or whether you're doing it on paper, you're kind of doing the same thing, which is this. You're thinking through, who are some interesting characters I want to spend time with? And what's the problems these characters are going to have to overcome? And what are they going to choose to try to overcome these problems, right? Like a story is interesting people trying to overcome interesting problems, right? And so you are going to outline out who you want to be spending time with as a writer and therefore who people will spend time with as a reader. Characters that are interesting, that have problems, that have goals, that have dreams, that have stuff they want to figure out, right? We want to spend time with people who are doers, who want to accomplish something, right? For the most part. And then what is the huge problems that these characters are going to be facing? And then you sit there and you iterate on what are the, given who this character is, what kind of choices might he make or she make to try to overcome this problem? And how does that lead to more choices and more problems? And so you're either iterating through those kind of things in outline form, writing it out. Who are my people? How do I get to know, like, write out who these characters are, get to know them on paper, right? Write out what the problems are you want them to face. Maybe you're experimenting in your imagination, building movies in your mind about these people. And maybe as you write, you're giving yourself anchor points so you don't forget the stuff you're making. Something like that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Perfect. Hey, thank you, guys, everyone, for joining us today. Now, if you had a question that we didn't get to, Brandon's actually going to be signing at which booth? Chris, where is he going to be at?
Printed Garden.
I'll be at a booth called The Printed Garden.
It's 1201.
Like 1201, it's out there on the floor. If you want to ask more questions, I'll be out there signing books. If you want to get a book signed, you can get a book signed. I think they also are a bookstore, so you could get a book if you don't have a book and you want to get a book signed. If you want to connect with me more in the future, I will be doing panels tomorrow. I'm doing one with Sanderson and like Veronica Roth and a couple people, in this room at 3 o'clock tomorrow, which should be a good one. It'll probably be hard to get in, because Sanderson is hard to get in sometimes. And it just pairing us all up, like it'll be probably a pretty good crowd. Then at 5 o'clock, I'll be in this room talking about all my stuff, like the fun side, like the stuff I've written, the stuff I have coming. That'll be tomorrow at 5. If you want to find me online, look at Facebook, Instagram, places like that. Thank you for coming out and spending time with us today. I really appreciate your questions. I hope you write awesome stuff. Thanks for showing up. Appreciate it.
Thank you.